sleepily, and gather in groups to talk and smoke as the workmen drop ramps and unload stock. August and his men arrive within minutes.
"Joe, you deal with the monkeys," says August. "Pete, Otis, unload the hay burners and get them watered, will you? Use the stream instead of troughs. We're conserving water."
"But don't unload Silver Star," I say. There's a long silence. The men look first at me, and then at August, whose gaze is steely.
"Yes," August finally says. "That's right. Don't unload Silver Star."
He turns and walks away. The other men regard me with wide eyes. I jog a little to catch up with August. "I'm sorry," I say, falling into stride beside him. "I didn't mean to give orders." He stops in front of the camel car and slides the door open. We're greeted by the grunts and complaints of distressed dromedaries.
"That's all right, my boy," August says cheerily, slinging a bucket of meat at me. "You can help me feed the cats."
I catch the bucket's thin metal handle. A cloud of angry flies rises from it. "Oh my God," I say. I set the bucket down and turn away, retching. I wipe tears from my eyes, still gagging. "August, we can't feed them this."
"Why not?"
"It's gone off." There's no answer. I turn and find that August has set a second bucket beside me and left. He's marching up the tracks, carting another two buckets. I grab mine and catch up. "It's putrid. Surely the cats won't eat this," I continue.
"Let's hope they do. Otherwise, we'll have to make some hard decisions."
"Huh?"
"We're still a long way from Joliet.
And alas, we're out of goats." I'm too stunned to answer. When we reach the second section of the train, August hops up onto a flat car and props open the sides of two cat dens. He opens the padlocks, leaves them hanging on the doors, and jumps down to the gravel.
"Go on, then," he says, thumping me on the back.
"What?"
"They get a bucket each. Go on," he urges.
I climb reluctantly onto the bed of the flat car. The odor of cat urine is overwhelming. August hands me the buckets of meat, one at a time. I set them on the weathered wooden boards, trying not to breathe. The cat dens have two compartments each. To my left is a pair of lions. To my right, a tiger and a panther, all four massive. They lift their heads, sniffing, their whiskers twitching.
"Well, go on then," says August.
"What do I do? Just open the door and toss it in?"
"Unless you can think of a better way."
The tiger rises, 600 glorious pounds of black, orange, and white. His head is huge, his whiskers long. He comes to the door, swings around, and walks away. When he returns, he growls and swipes at the latch. The padlock rattles against the bars.
"You can start with Rex," says August, pointing at the lions, which are also pacing. "That's him on the left."
Rex is considerably smaller than the tiger, with mats in his mane and ribs showing under his dull coat. I steel myself and reach for a bucket.
"Wait," says August, pointing at a different bucket. "Not that one. This one."
I can't see the difference, but since I've already ascertained that it's a bad idea to argue with August, I oblige. When the cat sees me coming, he lunges at the door. I freeze.
"What's the matter, Jacob?"
I turn around. August's face is glowing.
"You're not afraid of Rex, are you?" he continues. "He's just a little kitty cat."
Rex pauses to rub his mangy coat against the bars at the front of the cage. With fumbling fingers, I remove the padlock and lay it by my feet. Then I lift the bucket and wait. The next time Rex turns away from the door, I swing it open. Before I can tip the meat out, his huge jaws chomp down on my arm. I scream. The bucket crashes to the floor, splattering chopped entrails everywhere. The cat drops off my arm and pounces on the meat. I slam the door and hold it shut with my knee while I check whether I still have an arm. I do.
It is slick with saliva and as red as if I had dunked it in boiling water. But the skin isn't broken. A moment later, I realize August is laughing uproariously behind me. I turn to him. What the hell is wrong with you? You think that's funny?
Yeah, I do, yes, says August, making no effort to contain his mirth.
You're seriously fucked, you know that? I jump down from the flat car, check my intact arm once more, and stalk off.
Jacob, wait, laughs August, coming up behind me. Don't be sore. I was just having a little fun with you.
What fun? I could have lost my arm.
He hasn't got any teeth.
I halt, staring at the gravel beneath my feet as this fact sinks in. Then I continue walking. This time August doesn't follow. Furious, I head for the stream and kneel beside a couple of men watering zebras. One of the zebras spooks, barking and throwing his striped muzzle high in the air. The man holding the lead rope shoots a succession of glances at me as he struggles to maintain control. God damn it, he shouts. What is that? Is that blood? I look down. I'm spattered with blood from the entrails. Yes, I say. I was feeding the cats. The hell is wrong with you? You trying to get me killed? I walk downstream, looking back until the zebra calms down. Then I crouch by the water to rinse the blood and cat saliva from my arms. Eventually, I head back to the second section of the train. Diamond Joe is up on a flat next to a chimp den. The sleeves of his gray shirt are rolled up, exposing hairy, muscled arms. The chimp sits on his haunches, eating fistfuls of cereal mixed with fruit and watching us with shiny black eyes. Need help? I ask. Nah, about done, I think. I hear August got you with old Rex. I look up, prepared to be angry, but Joe's not smiling. Watch yourself, he says. Rex might not take your arm, but Leo will. You can bet on that. Don't know why August asked you to do it anyway. Clive is the cat man, unless he wanted to make a point. He pauses, reaches into the den, and touches fingers with the chimp before shutting the door. Then he jumps down from the flat. Look, I'm only going to say this once. August's a funny one, and I don't mean funny ha-ha. You be careful. He don't like no one questioning his authority. And he has his moments, if you know what I mean. I believe I do. No, I don't think you do. But you will. Say, you eaten yet? No. He points up the track to the flying squadron. There are tables set up alongside the track. Cookhouse crew got up a breakfast of sorts. Also put up some dookie boxes. Make sure you grab one, because that probably means we're not stopping again until tonight. Get it while the getting's good, I always say. Thanks, Joe. Don't mention it. I return to the stock car with my dookie box, which contains a ham sandwich, apple, and two bottles of sarsaparilla. When I see Marlena sitting in the straw beside Silver Star, I set my dookie box down and walk slowly toward her. Silver Star lies on his side, his flanks heaving, his respiration shallow and fast. Marlena sits at his head with her legs curled beneath her. He's not any better, is he? She says, looking up at me. I shake my head. I don't understand how this could happen so fast. Her voice is tiny and hollow, and it occurs to me that she's probably going to cry. I crouch beside her. Sometimes it just does. Not because of anything you did, though. She strokes his face, running her fingers around his dished cheek and down under his chin. His eyes flicker. Is there anything else we can do for him? She asks. Short of getting him off the train, no. Even under the best of circumstances, there's not a lot you can do but take them off their feet and pray. She glances at me and does a double take when she sees my arm. Oh my God, what happened to you? I look down. Oh, that, it's nothing. No, it's not, she says, climbing to her knees. She takes my forearm in her hands and moves it to catch the sunlight coming in through the slats. It looks new. It's going to be a heck of a bruise. Does this hurt? She takes the back of my arm in one hand and runs the other over the blue patch that's spreading beneath my skin. Her palm is cool and smooth and leaves my hair standing on end. I close my eyes and swallow hard. No, really, I'm... A whistle blows, and she looks toward the door. I take the opportunity to extricate my arm and rise.
20 minutes! Bellows a deep voice from somewhere near the front of the train. 20 minutes to push off!
Joe pokes his head through the open doorway. Come on, we gotta load these animals.
Oh, sorry, ma'am, he says, tipping his hat to Marlena. I didn't see you there.
That's okay, Joe.
Joe stands awkwardly in the doorway, waiting.
It's just that we've got to do it now, he says in desperation.
Go ahead, says Marlena.
I'm going to ride this leg with Silver Star.
You can't do that, I say quickly. She looks up at me, her throat elongated and pale.
Why ever not?
Because once we get the other horses loaded, you'll be trapped back here.
That's all right.
What if something happens?
Nothing's going to happen, and if it does, I'll climb over them.
She settles into the straw, curling her legs back under her.
I don't know, I say doubtfully. But Marlena is gazing at Silver Star with an expression that makes it perfectly clear she's not budging.
I look back at Joe, who raises his hands in a gesture of exasperation and surrender. After a final glance at Marlena, I swing the stall divider into place and help load the rest of the horses. Diamond Joe is right about the long haul. It's early evening before we stop again. Kinko and I haven't exchanged a word since we left Saratoga Springs. He clearly hates me. Not that I blame him. August set it up that way, although I don't suppose there's any point in trying to explain that to him. I stay up front with the horses to let him have some privacy. That, and I'm still nervous at the thought of Marlena trapped at the end of a row of 1,000-pound animals. When the train stops, she climbs nimbly over their backs and drops to the floor. When Kinko emerges from the goat room, his eyes crinkle in momentary alarm. Then they shift from Marlena to the open door with studied indifference. Pete, Otis, and I unload and water the ring stock, camels, and llamas. Diamond Joe, Clive, and a handful of cage hands head up to the second section of the train to deal with the animals and dens. August is nowhere to be seen. After we get the animals back on board, I climb into the stock car and poke my head into the room. Kinko sits cross-legged on the bed. Queenie sniffs a bedroll that has replaced the infested horse blanket. Sitting on top is a neatly folded red plaid blanket and a pillow in a smooth white case. A square sheet of cardboard lies in the center of the pillow. When I lean over to pick it up, Queenie leaps as though I've kicked her. Mr. and Mrs. August Rosenbluth request the pleasure of your immediate presence in stateroom 3, car 48, for cocktails, followed by a late dinner. I look up in surprise. Kinko is staring daggers at me.
You wasted no time ingratiating yourself, did you? He says.
Chapter 7.
The cars are not sequentially numbered, and it takes me a while to find car 48. It is painted a deep burgundy and trimmed with foot-tall gold lettering trumpeting Benzini Brothers' Most Spectacular Show on Earth. Just beneath that, visible only in relief under the shiny, fresh paint, is another name, Christie Brothers Circus.
Jacob,
Marlena's voice floats from a window. A few seconds later, she appears on the platform at the end, swinging out from the handrail so that her skirt swirls around her.
Jacob! Oh, I'm so glad you could make it. Please, come in.
Thanks, I say, glancing around. I climb up and follow her down the interior passageway and through the second door. Stateroom 3 is glorious, as well as a misnomer. It constitutes half the car and contains at least one additional room, which is cordoned off with a thick velvet curtain. The main room is paneled in walnut and outfitted with damask furniture, a dinette, and a Pullman kitchen.
Please make yourself comfortable,
says Marlena, waving me toward one of the chairs.
August will be along in a minute.
Thank you, I say. She sits opposite me.
Oh,
she says, leaping up again.
Where are my manners? Would you like a beer?
Thank you, I say. That would be swell. She flutters past me to an icebox.
Mrs. Rosenbluth, can I ask you something?
Oh, please, call me Marlena, she says, popping the bottle cap.
She tips a tall glass and pours beer slowly down its side, avoiding a foam head.
And yes, by all means, ask away.
She hands me the glass and then returns to get another.
How is it that everyone on this train has so much alcohol?
We always head to Canada at the beginning of the season, she says, taking her seat again. Their laws are much more civilized.
Cheers,
she says, holding out her glass. I touch mine to hers and take a sip. It's a cold, clean lager. Magnificent. Don't the border guards check?
We put the booze in with the camels, she says.
I'm sorry, I don't understand, I say.
Camels spit.
I nearly spurt beer through my nose. She giggles, too, and brings a hand demurely to her mouth. Then she sighs and puts her beer down.
Jacob?
Yes?
August told me about what happened this morning.
I glance at my bruised arm.
It feels terrible. He likes you. He really does. It's just, well, it's complicated.
She looks into her lap, blushing.
Hey, it's nothing, I say. It's fine.
Jacob, shouts August from behind me. My dear fellow, so glad you could join our little soiree. I see Marlena set you up with a drinky poo. Has she shown you the dressing room yet?
The dressing room?
Marlena, he says, turning and shaking his head sadly. He waggles a finger in reprimand. Tisk, tisk, darling.
Oh, she says, leaping to her feet. I completely forgot.
August walks to the velvet curtain and whisks it aside.
Ta-da!
There are three outfits lying side by side on the bed. Two tuxedos, complete with shoes and a beautiful rose silk dress with beading on its neck and hemline. Marlena squeals, clapping her hands in delight. She rushes to the bed and grabs the dress, pressing it to her body and twirling. I turn to August.
These aren't from the Monday, man.
A tux on a wash line? No, Jacob. Being equestrian director has the odd perk. You can clean up in there, he says, pointing to a polished wooden door. Marlena and I will change out here. Nothing we haven't seen before, eh, darling? He says.
She grabs a rose silk shoe by the heel and chucks it at him. The last thing I see as I shut the bathroom door is a tangle of feet toppling forward onto the bed. When I come back out, Marlena and August are the picture of dignity, hovering in the background as three white-gloved waiters fuss with a small wheeled table and silver-domed platters. The neckline of Marlena's dress barely covers her shoulders, exposing her collarbone and a slim bra strap. She follows my gaze and tucks the strap back under the material, blushing once again. The dinner is sublime. We start with oyster bisque and follow with prime rib, boiled potatoes, and asparagus in cream. Then comes lobster salad. By the time dessert appears, English plum pudding with brandy sauce. I don't think I can take another bite. And yet, a few minutes later, I find myself scraping my plate with my spoon.
Apparently, Jacob doesn't find dinner up to snuff, August says in a slow drawl.
I freeze, mid-scrape. Then he and Marlena dissolve into fits of giggles. I set my spoon down, mortified.
No, 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 my boy, I'm joking. Obviously,
he chortles, leaning over to pat my hand.
Eat, enjoy yourself. Here, have some more, he says.
No, I couldn't possibly.
Well, have some more wine, then,
he says, refilling my glass without waiting for a response. August is gracious, charming, and mischievous. So much so that as the evening wears on, I begin to think the incident with Rex was just a joke gone awry. His face glows with wine and sentiment as he regales me with the tale of how he wooed Marlena, of how he recognized her powerful way with horses, the very moment she entered his menagerie tent 3 years before, sensed it from the horses themselves, and how, to the great distress of Uncle Al, he refused to budge until he had swept her off her feet and married her.
It took some doing,
says August, emptying the remains of one champagne bottle into my glass and then reaching for another.
Marlena's no pushover. Plus, she was practically engaged at the time. But
This beats being the wife of a stuffy banker, doesn't it, darling? At any rate, it's what she was born to do. Not everyone can work with Liberty horses. It's a God-given talent, a sixth sense, if you will. This girl speaks horse, and believe me, they listen.
4 hours and 6 bottles into the evening, August and Marlena dance to Maybe It's the Moon. And while I lounge in an upholstered chair with my right leg draped over its arm, August twirls Marlena around, then stops with her extended from the end of his straightened arm. He's weaving, his dark hair tousled. His bow tie trails from either end of his collar, and the first few buttons of his shirt are undone. He stares at Marlena with such intensity he looks like a different man.
"What's the matter?" says Marlena. "Augie, are you all right?"
He continues to stare into her face, cocking his head as though evaluating her. The edge of his lip curls. He starts to nod, slowly, barely moving his head. Marlena's eyes grow wide. She tries to step backward, but he catches her chin with his hand.
I sit forward suddenly on full alert.
August stares for a moment longer, his eyes shiny and hard. Then his face transforms again, becoming so sloppy that for a moment I think he's going to burst into tears. He pulls her to him by the chin and kisses her full on the lips. Then he steers himself into the bedroom and collapses, face first, onto the bed.
"Excuse me a moment," Marlena says.
She goes into the bedroom and rolls him over so he's sprawled across the center of the bed. She removes his shoes and drops them to the floor. When she comes out, she pulls the velvet curtain shut and immediately changes her mind. She pulls it open again, turns off the radio, and sits opposite me. A snore of kingly proportions rumbles from the bedroom. My head is buzzing. I am entirely drunk.
"What the hell was that?" I ask.
"What?" Marlena kicks off her shoes, crosses her legs, and leans forward to rub the arch of her foot. August's fingers have left red marks on her chin.
"That,"
I sputter, "just now when you were dancing." She looks up sharply. Her face contorts, and for a moment I'm afraid she's going to cry. Then she turns to the window and holds a finger to her lips. She's silent for almost half a minute.
"I have to understand something about Augie," she says, "and I don't quite know how to explain it."
I lean forward.
"Try. He's mercurial. He's capable of being the most charming man on earth, like tonight."
I wait for her to continue. "And?" She leans back in her chair.
"And, well, he has moments. Like today."
"What about today?"
"He nearly fed you to a cat."
"Oh, that. I can't say I was thrilled, but I was hardly in danger. Rex has no teeth."
"No, but he's 400 pounds and he has claws,"
she says quietly.
I set my wine glass on the table as the enormity of this sinks in.
Marlena pauses, then lifts her eyes to meet mine.
"Jankowski is a Polish name, isn't it?"
"Yes, of course.
Poles do not, in general, like Jews."
I didn't realize August was Jewish.
"With a name like Rosenbluth?" she says.
She looks at her fingers, twisting them in her lap.
"My family is Catholic. They disowned me when they found out." "I'm sorry to hear that, although I'm not surprised." She looks up sharply.
I didn't mean it like that," I say. "I'm not like that." An uncomfortable silence stretches between us. "So, why am I here?" I finally ask. My drunken brain is unable to process all of this.
"I wanted to smooth things over."
"You did? He didn't want me here?"
"No, of course he did. He wanted to make it up to you too, but it's harder for him. He can't help his little moments. They embarrass him. The best thing to do is pretend they didn't happen."
She sniffs and turns to me with a tight smile.
"And we had a lovely time, didn't we?"
"Yes, dinner was lovely, thank you." As yet another silence engulfs us, it dawns on me that unless I want to try leaping across train cars drunk and in the dead of night, I'll be sleeping right where I am.
Please, Jacob, says Marlena. I do so want things to be all right between us. August is simply delighted you've joined us, and so is Uncle Al.
And why is that exactly?
Uncle Al was touchy about not having a vet, and then out of the blue, here you are. From an Ivy League school, no less.
I stare, still trying to comprehend.
Ringling has a vet, Marlena continues. And being like Ringling makes Uncle Al happy.
I thought he hated Ringling.
Darling, he wants to be Ringling.
I lean my head back and shut my eyes, but this results in disastrous spinning, so I open them again and try to focus on the feet dangling from the end of the bed. When I wake up, the train has stopped. Can I really have slept through the screeching brakes? The sun is shining on me through the window, and my brain pounds against my skull. My eyes ache, and my mouth tastes like a sewer. I stagger to my feet and glance into the bedroom. August is curled around Marlena, his arm lying across her. They're on top of the bedspread, still fully dressed. I get a few odd looks when I emerge from car 48 dressed in a tux with my other clothes tucked under my arm. At this end of the train, where most of the onlookers are performers, I'm regarded with frosty amusement. As I pass the working men's sleepers, the glances become harder, more suspicious. I climb gingerly into the stock car and push open the door of the little room. Kinko is sitting on the edge of his cot, an 8-pager in one hand, and his penis in the other. He stops mid-stroke, its slick purple head extending beyond his fist. There's a heartbeat of silence, followed by the whoosh of an empty Coke bottle flying at my head. I duck. Get out! Kinko screams as the bottle explodes against the doorframe behind me. He leaps up, causing his erection to bounce wildly. Get the hell out! He lobs another bottle at me. I turn to the door, shielding my head and dropping my clothes. I hear a zipper running up, and a moment later, the complete works of Shakespeare smash into the wall beside me. Okay, okay, I shout. I'm leaving. I pull the door shut behind me and lean against the wall. The curses continue unabated. Otis appears outside the stock car. He looks in alarm at the closed door and then shrugs. Hey, fancy boy, he says. You gonna help us with these animals or what? Sure, of course. I jump to the ground. He stares at me. What? I say. Ain't you gonna change out of the monkey suit first? I glance back at the closed door. Something heavy slams against the interior wall. No, I think I'll stay like I am for the time being. Your call. Clive's cleaned out the cats. He wants us to bring the meat. There's even more noise coming from the camel car this morning. Them hay burners sure don't like traveling with meat, says Otis. Wish they'd stop kicking up such a fuss, though. We got a bit farther to go. I slide the door open. Flies explode outward. I see the maggots just as the smell hits. I manage to stagger a few feet away before vomiting. Otis joins me, doubled over, clasping his hands to his gut. After he finishes throwing up, he takes a few deep breaths and pulls a filthy handkerchief from his pocket. He clasps it over his mouth and nose and returns to the car. He grabs a bucket, runs to the tree line, and dumps it. He holds his breath until he's halfway back. Then he stops, bent over with his hands on his knees, gasping for air. I try to help, but every time I get near, my diaphragm erupts in fresh spasms. I'm sorry, I say when Otis returns. I'm still gagging. I can't do it. I just can't. He shoots me a dirty look. My stomach's off, I say, feeling the need to explain. I drank too much last night. Yeah, I'll bet you did, he says. Have a seat, monkey boy. I'll take care of it. Otis dumps the rest of the meat at the tree line, leaving it in a heap that buzzes with flies. We leave the door to the camel car wide open, but it's clear a simple airing out won't be sufficient. We lead the camels and llamas down the tracks and tie them to the side of the train. Then we slosh buckets of water across the floorboards using push brooms to sluice the resulting muck from the car. The stench is still overwhelming, but it's the best we can do. After we tend to the rest of the animals, I return to the ring stock car. Silver Star is lying on his side, and Marlena is kneeling next to him, still wearing the rose dress from the night before. I walk past the long line of open stall dividers and stand beside her. Silver Star's eyes are barely open. He flinches and grunts in reaction to some unseen stimulus.
He's worse, Marlena says without looking at me.
After a moment, I say, yes.
Is there any chance he'll recover? Any chance at all?
I hesitate, because what's on the tip of my tongue is a lie, and I find I can't utter it.
You can tell me the truth, she says. I need to know.
No, I'm afraid there's no chance at all. She lays a hand on his neck, holding it there.
In that case, promise me it will be quick. I don't want him to suffer.
I understand what she's asking me, and shut my eyes. I promise. She rises and stands staring down at him. I'm marveling and not just a little unnerved at her stoic reaction when a strange noise rises from her throat. It's followed by a moan, and next thing I know she's bawling. She doesn't even try to wipe the tears that slide down her cheeks, just stands, hugging her arms with shoulders heaving, gasping for breath. She looks like she's going to collapse in on herself. I stare in horror. I have no sisters, and my limited experience with comforting women has always been over something a hell of a lot less devastating than this. After a few moments of indecision, I lay a hand on her shoulder. She turns and falls against me, pressing her wet cheek into my August's tuxedo shirt. I rub her back, making shushing noises until her tears finally subside into jerky hiccups. Then she pulls away. Her eyes and nose are swollen and pink, her face slick with mucus. She sniffs and wipes her lower lashes with the back of each hand, as though that will do any good. Then she straightens her shoulders and leaves without looking back, her high heels tapping down the length of the car. August, I say, standing beside the bed and shaking his shoulder. He flops limply, as responsive as a corpse. I lean and shout in his ear, August! He grunts, irritated. August, wake up! Finally, he shifts, rolling and placing a hand over his eyes. Oh, God, he says. Oh, God, I think my head is going to explode. Close the curtain, will you? Do you have a gun? The hand drops from the eyes. He sits up. What? I have to put Silver Star down. You can't. I have to. You heard Uncle Al. If anything happens to that horse, you'll be red-lighted. Which means what exactly? Chucked from the train. When it's moving. If you're lucky, within sight of a train yard's red light so you can find your way to town. If you're not, well, you'd just better hope they don't open the door while the train's crossing a trestle. Camel's remark about having an appointment with Blackie suddenly makes sense, as do various comments from my first meeting with Uncle Al. In that case, I'll take my chances and stay right here when the train pulls out. But either way, that horse needs putting down. August stares at me with black-ringed eyes. Shit, he says finally. He swings his legs around so that he's sitting at the edge of the bed. He rubs his stubbled cheeks. Does Marlena know? He asks, leaning over to scratch his black-socked toes. Yes. Fuck, he says, getting to his feet. He holds one hand to his head. Al's gonna have a fit. Okay. Meet me at the stock car in a few minutes. I'll bring the gun. I turn to leave. Oh, Jacob? Yes, I say. Change out of my tux first, will you? When I get back to the stock car, the interior door is open. I poke my head in with more than a little trepidation, but Kinko is gone. I go inside and change into my regular clothes. A few minutes later, August shows up with a rifle. Here, he says, climbing the ramp.
He hands me the gun and drops two shells into my other palm. I slip one into my pocket and hold the other one out. I only need one.
What if you miss?
For crying out loud, August, I'm going to be standing right next to him. He stares at me and then takes the extra shell.
Okay, fine. Take him a good ways from the train to do it.
You've got to be kidding. He can't walk.
You can't do it here, he says. The other horses are right outside.
I just look at him.
Shit,
he finally says. He turns and leans against the wall, his fingers beating a tattoo against the slats.
Okay, fine.
He walks to the door.
Otis, Joe, get the other horses out of here. Take them at least as far up as the second section.
Someone outside mumbles.
Yeah, I know, says August, but they're just going to have to wait. Yeah, I know that. I'll talk to Al and tell him we have a little complication.
He turns back to me.
I'm going to find Al.
You better find Marlena, too.
I thought you said she knew.
She does, but I don't want her to be alone when she hears that shot, do you? August stares at me long and hard. Then he clomps down the ramp, planting his feet with such force the boards bounce beneath him. I wait a full 15 minutes, both to give August time to find Uncle Al and Marlena, and also to let the other men move the rest of the animals far enough away. Finally, I pick up the rifle, slide the shell into the chamber, and throw the bolt. Silver Star's muzzle is pressed up against the end of his stall, his ears twitching. I lean over and run my fingers down his neck. Then I place the muzzle of the gun under his left ear and pull the trigger. There's an explosion of sound and the butt of the rifle bucks into my shoulder. Silver Star's body seizes, his muscles responding to one last synaptical spasm before finally falling still. From far away, I hear a single desperate whinny. My ears are ringing as I climb down from the stock car. But even so, it seems to me that the scene is eerily silent. A small crowd of people is gathered. They stand motionless, their faces long. One man pulls his hat from his head and presses it to his chest. I walk a few dozen yards from the train, climb the grassy bank, and sit, rubbing my shoulder. Otis, Pete, and Earl enter the stock car and then reappear, hauling Silver Star's lifeless body down the ramp by a rope tied to his hind feet. Upside down, his body looks huge and vulnerable, a smooth expanse of snowy white dotted by black skin genitals. His lifeless head nods in agreement with each yank of the rope. I sit for close to an hour, staring at the grass between my feet. I pluck a few blades and roll them in my fingers, wondering why the hell it's taking them so long to pull out. After a while, August approaches. He stares at me, and then leans over to pick up the rifle. I hadn't been aware of bringing it with me. Come on, pal, he says. Don't want to get left behind. I think I do. Don't worry about what I said earlier. I talked to Al, and no one's getting red-lighted. You're fine. I stare sullenly at the ground. After a while, August sits beside me. Or are you? He says. How's Marlena? I respond. August watches me for a moment and then digs a package of Camels from his shirt pocket. He shakes one loose and offers it to me. No, thanks, I say. Is that the first time you've shot a horse? He says, plucking the cigarette from the package with his teeth. No, but it doesn't mean I like it.
Part of being a vet, my boy.
Which technically I'm not.
So you missed the exams. Big deal.
It is a big deal.
No, it isn't. It's just a piece of paper, and nobody here gives a damn about that. You're on a show now. The rules are different.
How so? He waves toward the train.
Tell me, do you honestly think this is the most spectacular show on Earth?
I don't answer.
Eh?
He says, leaning into me with his shoulder. I don't know.
No, it's nowhere near. It's probably not even the 50th most spectacular show on Earth. We hold maybe
a third of the capacity Ringling does. You already know that Marlene is not Romanian royalty. And Lucinda? Nowhere near 885 pounds. 400 tops. And do you really think Frank Otto got tattooed by angry headhunters in Borneo? Hell no. He used to be a stake driver on the Flying Squadron. He worked on that ink for 9 years. And you want to know what Uncle Al did when the hippo died? He swapped out her water for formaldehyde and kept on showing her. For 2 weeks, we traveled with a pickled hippo. The whole thing's illusion, Jacob. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's what people want from us. It's what they expect.
He stands up and holds out a hand. After a moment, I take it and let him pull me to my feet. We walk toward the train.
Damn, August, I say. I almost forgot. The cats haven't eaten. We had to dump their meat.
It's all right, my boy, he says. It's already been taken care of.
What do you mean, taken care of? I stop in my tracks.
August, what do you mean it's been taken care of?
August continues walking, the gun slung casually over his shoulder.
Chapter 8.
Wake up, Mr. Jankowski. You're having a bad dream. My eyes snap open. Where am I? Oh, hell and damnation. I wasn't dreaming, I protest. Well, you were talking in your sleep, sure enough, says the nurse. It's the nice black girl again. Why do I have such trouble remembering her name? Something about feeding stars to cats. Now, don't you go fretting about those cats. I'm sure they got fed, even if it was after you woke up. Now, why did they go and put these on you? She muses, ripping open my Velcro wrist restraints. You didn't try to run off now, did you? No. I had the audacity to complain about that pablum they feed us. I glanced sideways at her. And then my plate sort of slid off the table. She stops and looks at me. And she bursts out laughing. Oh, you're alive one, all right, she says, rubbing my wrists between her warm hands. Oh, my. It comes to me in a flash. Rosemary. Ha! So I'm not senile after all. Rosemary, Rosemary, Rosemary. I must think of a way to commit it to memory. A rhyme or something. I may have remembered this morning, but that's no guarantee. I'll remember it tomorrow or even later today. She goes to the window and opens the blinds. Do you mind? I say. Do I mind what? She replies. Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't this my room? What if I don't want the blinds open? I tell you, I'm getting mighty sick of everyone thinking they know better than I do about what I want. Rosemary gazes at me. Then she drops the blinds and marches from the room, letting the door shut behind her. My mouth opens in surprise. A moment later, there are three taps on the door. It opens a crack. Good morning, Mr. Jankowski. May I come in? What the hell game is she playing? I said, may I come in? She repeats. Of course, I sputter. Thank you kindly, she says, coming in and standing at the foot of my bed. Now, would you like me to open the blinds and let the good Lord's sun shine in on you? Or would you rather sit here in pitch darkness all day long? Oh, go ahead and open them, and stop it with that nonsense. It's not nonsense, Mr. Jankowski, she says, going to the window and opening the blinds. Not a bit of it. I'd never thought of it that way before, and I thank you for opening my eyes. Is she making fun of me? I narrow my eyes examining her face for clues. Now, am I correct in thinking you'd like breakfast in your room? I don't answer, as I'm still undecided as to whether I smell a rat. You'd think they'd have that preference written on my chart by now, but they ask me the same damn question every morning. Of course I would rather take my breakfast in the dining room. Taking it in my bed makes me feel like an invalid. But breakfast follows the early morning diaper change, and the smell of feces fills the hallway and makes me retch. It's not until an hour or two after each and every one of the incapacitated folks has been cleaned, fed, and parked outside their doors that it's safe to poke your head out. Now, Mr. Jankowski, if you expect people to try to do things your way, you're going to have to give some hints as to what that way is. Yes, please. I'll have it in here, I say. All right, then. Would you like your shower before or after breakfast? What makes you think I need a shower? I say, thoroughly offended, even though I'm not at all sure I don't need a shower. Because this is the day your people visit, she says, flashing that big smile again. And because I thought you'd like to be nice and fresh for your outing this afternoon. My outing? Ah, yes, the circus. I must say, waking up 2 days in a row and having the prospect of a visit to the circus ahead of me has been nice. I think I'll take it before breakfast, if you don't mind, I say pleasantly. One of the greatest indignities about being old is that people insist on helping you with things like bathing and going to the washroom. I don't, in fact, require help with either, but they're all so afraid I'm going to slip and break my hip again that I get a chaperone whether I like it or not. I always insist on walking into the washroom myself, but there's always someone there just in case, and for some reason, it's always a woman. I make whoever it is turn around while I drop my drawers and sit, and then I send her outside until I'm finished. Bathing is even more embarrassing because I have to strip down to my birthday suit in front of a nurse. Now, there are some things that never die, so even though I'm in my 90s, my sap sometimes rises. I can't help it. They always pretend not to notice. They're trained that way, I suppose, although pretending not to notice is almost worse than noticing. It means they consider me nothing more than a harmless old man sporting a harmless old penis that still gets uppity once in a while. Although, if one of them took it seriously and tried to do something about it, the shock would probably kill me. Rosemary helps me into the shower stall. There, now you just hold on to that bar over there. I know. I've had showers before, I say, grabbing the bar and easing myself onto the bath chair. Rosemary runs the shower head down the pole so I can reach it. How's that for temperature, Mr. Jankowski? She asks, waving her hand in and out of the stream and keeping her gaze discreetly averted. Fine. Just give me some shampoo and go outside, will you? Why, Mr. Jankowski, you are in a mood today, aren't you? She opens the shampoo and squeezes a few drops onto my palm. It's all I need. I've only got about a dozen hairs left. You give me a shout if you need anything, she says, pulling the curtain across. I'll be right out here. Humph, I say. When she's gone, I quite enjoy my shower. I take the shower head from its mount and spray my body from up close, aiming it over my shoulders and down my back, and then over each of my skinny limbs. I even hold my head back with my eyes shut and let the spray hit my face full on. I pretend it's a tropical shower, shaking my head and reveling in it. I even enjoy the feel of it down there on that shriveled pink snake that fathered 5 children so long ago. Sometimes when I'm in bed, I close my eyes and remember the look, and especially the feel, of a woman's naked body. Usually it's my wife's, but not always. I was completely faithful to her. Not once in more than 60 years did I stray, except in my imagination. And I have a feeling she wouldn't have minded that. She was a woman of extraordinary understanding. Dear Lord, I miss that woman. Not just because if she was still alive, I wouldn't be here, although that's the God's truth. No matter how decrepit we became, we would have looked after each other like we always did. But after she was gone, I didn't stand a chance against the kids. The first time I took a fall, they had it sewn up as quick as you can say crackerjack. "But Dad," they said, "you broke your hip." As though maybe I hadn't noticed. I dug in my heels. I threatened to cut them off without a cent, until I remembered they already controlled my money. They didn't remind me. They just let me rail on like an old fool until I remembered of my own accord. And that made me even angrier, because if they had any respect for me at all, they would have at least made sure I had the facts straight. I felt like a toddler whose tantrum was being allowed to run its course. As the enormity of my helplessness dawned on me, my position began to slip. "You're right," I conceded. "I guess I could use some help. I suppose having someone come in during the day wouldn't be so bad, just to help out with the cooking and cleaning." "No? Well, how about a live-in? I know I've let things slip a little since your mother died, but I thought you said, okay, then one of you can move in with me." "But I don't understand." "Well, Simon, your house is large. Surely I could..." It was not to be. I remember leaving my house for the last time, bundled up like a cat on the way to the vet. As the car pulled away, my eyes were so clouded by tears I couldn't look back. "It's not a nursing home," they said. "It's assisted living. Progressive, you see? You'll only have help for the things you need. And then when you get older..." They always trailed off there, as though that would prevent me from following the thought to its logical conclusion. For a long time, I felt betrayed that not one of my 5 children offered to take me in. No longer. Now that I've had time to mull it over, I see that they've got enough problems without adding me into the mix. Simon is around 70 and has had at least one heart attack. Ruth has diabetes, and Peter has prostate trouble. Joseph's wife ran off with a cabana boy when they were in Greece. And while Dinah's breast cancer seems to have gone into remission, thank God, now she's got her granddaughter living with her, trying to get the girl back on track after 2 illegitimate children and an arrest for shoplifting. And those are just the things I know about. There are a host of others they don't mention, because they don't want to upset me. I've caught wind of several, but when I ask questions, they clam right up. "Mustn't upset Grandpa, you know." "Why? That's what I want to know. I hate this bizarre policy of protective exclusion, because it effectively writes me off the page. If I don't know what's going on in their lives, how am I supposed to insert myself in the conversation?" "I've decided it's not about me at all. It's a protective mechanism for them. A way of buffering themselves against my future death. Like when teenagers distance themselves from their parents in preparation for leaving home. When Simon turned 16 and got belligerent, I thought it was just him. By the time Dinah got there, I knew it wasn't her fault. It was programmed into her. But despite bowdlerizing content, My family has been entirely faithful about visiting. Someone comes every single Sunday, come hell or high water. They talk and they talk and they talk about how fine or foul or fair the weather is, and what they did on vacation and what they ate for lunch. And then at 5 on the nose, they look gratefully at the clock and leave. Sometimes they try to get me to go to the bingo game down the hall on their way out, like the batch from 2 weeks ago. "Wouldn't you like to join in?" they said. "We could take you there on our way out. Doesn't that sound like fun?" "Sure," I said. "Maybe if you're a rutabaga." And they laughed, which pleased me even though I wasn't joking. At my age, you take credit for whatever you can. At least it proved they were listening. My platitudes don't hold their interest, and I can hardly blame them for that. My real stories are all out of date. So what if I can speak firsthand about the Spanish flu, the advent of the automobile, world wars, cold wars, guerrilla wars, and Sputnik? That's all ancient history now. But what else do I have to offer? Nothing happens to me anymore. That's the reality of getting old. And I guess that's really the crux of the matter. I'm not ready to be old yet. But I shouldn't complain, this being circus day and all. Rosemary returns with a breakfast tray, and when she pulls off the brown plastic lid, I see that she's put cream and brown sugar on my porridge. "Now, don't you go telling Dr. Rashid about the cream," she says. "Why not? I'm not supposed to have cream?" "Not you specifically. It's part of the specialized diet. Some of our residents can't digest rich things the way they used to." "What about butter?" I'm outraged. My mind skips back over the last weeks, months, and years, trying to remember the last appearance of cream or butter in my life. Dang it, she's right. Why didn't I notice? Or maybe I did, and that's why I dislike the food so much. Well, it's no wonder. I suppose we're on reduced salt as well. "It's supposed to keep you healthier for longer," she says, shaking her head. "But why you folks shouldn't enjoy a bit of butter in your golden years, I don't know." She looks up sharply. "You still have your gallbladder, don't you?" "Yes." Her face softens again. "Well, in that case, you enjoy that cream, Mr. Jankowski. Do you want your TV on while you eat?" "No, there's nothing but garbage on these days anyway," I say. "I couldn't agree more," she says, refolding the blanket at the foot of my bed. "You give me a buzz if you need anything else." After she leaves, I resolve to be nicer. I'll have to think of a way of reminding myself. I suppose I could wrap a bit of napkin around my finger, since I don't have any string. People were always doing that in movies when I was younger. Wrapping strings around their fingers to remember things, that is. I reach for the napkin, and as I do, I catch sight of my hands. They're knobby and crooked, thin-skinned, and like my ruined face, covered with liver spots. My face. I push the porridge aside and open my vanity mirror. I should know better by now, but somehow I still expect to see myself. Instead, I find an Appalachian apple doll, withered and spotty, with dewlaps and bags and long floppy ears. A few strands of white hair spring absurdly from its spotted skull. I try to brush the hairs flat with my hand and freeze at the sight of my old hand on my old head. I lean close and open my eyes very wide, trying to see beyond the sagging flesh. It's no good. Even when I look straight into the milky blue eyes, I can't find myself anymore. When did I stop being me? I'm too sickened to eat. I put the brown lid back on the porridge, and then with considerable difficulty locate the pad that controls my bed.